Bible Students History, Tracing the Fingerprints of God. Tracing the Fingerprints of God. May the Lord bless you for this evening.
Thank you, Brother Lou. We first want to bring the love of the Puget Sound class and the Wenatchee class. And there we go. And also we want to mention, for some of you, this subject may be a review. But we thought it was particularly important to share today. It bears directly on the theme text. We felt that there was really nothing more sobering on this text than historical example. We hope that it can pave the way for the symposium and the topical testimony that follows. And I hope you guys, you know, think about that topical testimony too, and really consider consider how we can retain these precious truths we have. Now the theme text again, we want to keep it in mind. Hebrews 2:1. Therefore we ought to give more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip. Today we're going to trace the fingerprints of God in the 1914 expectations and impact. We're going to trace his doctrines and his dealings in the events of 1914 and after. We will cover 9 considerations. 1. 1914, the impact then. 2. Truth just in time. 3. Major prophetic framework. And 4. Perilous times. We will then cover the movements that formed right after the pastor's death. So our 5th consideration is Rutherford's organization. 6th, the layman's. 7, the Standfast Movement. And 8, the PBI. And finally, 9, the Independents. Let's not miss the lessons. It is so true that those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it. So true. Our first consideration is 1914, impact then. As you can imagine, the excitement ran high leading up to 1914. That excitement continued for many. But shortly after 1914, some of the brethren were affected differently. Despite the pastor's warnings, some had sold homes and farms. Others did not get married. Some decided not to have families. A few, and I emphasize a few, of these became bitter and blamed the pastor for their own decisions. Despite the warnings, these had consecrated to a date. Now, brethren, we are consecrated unto death. In fact, we are consecrated for all eternity. All eternity. One more point on these warnings. When we read these articles just prior to 1914, which seem to minimize chronology and prophecy, let's remember why they were written. Their internal context makes it clear. Leading up to 1914, the pastor minimized chronology in case there was any miscalculation. He encouraged all to hang on to the fundamentals. He did this so if nothing happened that year, the brethren would not be stumbled by the outcome. But brethren, we live after 1914. We are looking back on fulfilled prophecy And wow, was it ever fulfilled? It came out to the very day. World War I began to the very day that the Gentile times ended. Now for our second consideration, truth just in time. Today, we will be looking at different aspects of God's purposes in revealing the harvest message gradually. When considering the pastor's expectations, one thing sticks out. The truth was revealed just in time. Let's remember the whole harvest message itself was supplied just in time. It came at the end of the 1880s when faith in the Bible had been attacked on every side. A crisis was sweeping over the Christian world. Evolution, higher criticism, and Christian Science were attacking the very foundation of Christian beliefs. The sun, the gospel message, and the moon, lesson of the law, were being darkened. The social gospel was taking the place of the cross of Christ. The harvest message gave solid answers just in time. Present truth did not come like a flash of lightning. The information was not transferred to the pastor instantaneously through dreams, etc. If it had been, we would be leery. The scriptures indicate that only the apostles and prophets were inspired. The truth came like it had come throughout the age. It came gradually. But unlike earlier in the age, much more truth was needed. The pastor's understanding solidified just before each volume was written. Important truths on things like 1881, the door, and the general call were solidified just before volumes 2 and 3 were written. These were truths needed for those volumes. Even with the tabernacle, he gained the truth necessary just as it was needed. The ransom was being attacked. Tabernacle types were being misused to support a no-ransom error. The brethren were in danger of being stumbled by it. He reasoned that if such errors were being printed, it must be time for the truth on the tabernacle. The Lord supplied it just in time. All this is extremely faith-strengthening. As early as 1904, Brother Russell came to realize that some of the trouble would come after 1914. There, he expected the worst of the trouble between 1914 and 1915. Reprint 3989 presents this adjustment. During all of 1915, he was still sorting out the evidence. Finally, in 1916, things became clear. Again, just in time. The forewords were written in October 1916, just days before his death. Just days. Let's read one clarification and summarize the rest. This one gives a powerful reason for the seeming delay. Volume 2, forward, page BIII. We could not, of course, know in 1889 whether the date 1914, so clearly marked in the Bible as the end of the Gentile lease of power or permission to rule the world, would mean that they would be fully out of power at that time, or whether their lease expiring, their eviction would begin. The latter we perceived to be the Lord's program, and promptly in August 1914, the Gentile kingdoms referred to in the prophecy began the present great struggle, which according to the Bible will culminate in the complete overthrow of all human government. No wonder more trouble did not come before 1914. No wonder it had seemed to tarry. Of course, it did not make sense to evict a tenant before the lease expired. Now let's summarize the remaining. The 1916 second volume forward had two extremely important clarifications. One, the Gentile times do not point to the end of the destruction, but to the beginning. Two, the parallels do not apply to the true church and its glorification, but to the nominal and its destruction. The third volume forward adds a third clarification. Three, the door was not shut. The harvesting continued. And just as a side note, something happened in 1913 that we do not want to miss. In London, Brother Russell had a serious heart attack. Can you imagine what would have happened if he had died in 1913? Brother Hudson recorded it. His doctor did not expect him to survive, but he did. Again, the Lord clearly overruled for the good of his people. Next, our third consideration. Major prophetic framework. As we proceed, one thing will stand out. In regard to prophecy, there was a marked difference between the clarifications before the pastor's death and the changes and new light that came out after. In the pastor's progression of thought, the major prophetic framework remained constant. The timing of the Gentile times, jubilees, parallels, and chronology remained solid throughout his ministry. The pastor did not question that framework. Why? Because in it, he could trace the fingerprints of God. He could see the incredible harmony of how these pieces all fit together. He could see that these prophecies with that same harmony were displayed in the pyramid as well. No human could have contrived it. But the harmony and beauty can only be seen by those that thoroughly prove it. A surface reading is not enough. The surface reader will not be able to trace the fingerprints of God. The power of the truth is in the proof. It's in the scriptures themselves. It's in the multiple internal proofs of each prophecy. It is then the combined testimony of all these prophecies together that reveal the fingerprints of God. Again, how do we know? Because no man could have fabricated it. Proverbs 22:20-21. Have I not written to thee excellent things and counsels and knowledge, that I might make thee know the certainty of the words of truth? Our fourth consideration is perilous times. Were the brethren warned as to what was about to come? Had the Lord prepared them? In a November 1st, 1916 article that the pastor penned just before his death, we have an amazing warning. It is just like the Lord to give us warnings just before they're needed. Reprint 5981. We believe that a great crisis is upon the Bible students, and that the sooner it is discerned, the more successfully it may be passed. Further on it states, from reports given us, a horrible state of affairs prevails in some classes. When an election is held, the servants of the church attempt to be rulers, dictators. Evidence to watch out for were given. It continues. We have already alluded to the ambitious and selfish spirit in the world leading on to anarchy. And we have just pointed out how the same selfish spirit is leading on to anarchy in the church. Ours is the spirit of the Master, the spirit of loyalty to the truth, the spirit of the golden rule, the spirit of brotherly love, the spirit of liberty and helpfulness, the spirit of fidelity to what we believe to be the truth. It is inexcusable for the church possessed of this spirit to continue under the domination of ambitious men. Galatians 5:1. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again in the yoke of bondage. Reprint 5:9-8:1 also warns of doctrinal tests. 2 Timothy 4:3-4. For the time will come when they shall not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap themselves teachers, having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall turn unto fables. Finally, Colossians 2:8. Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit. After the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. The brethren were about to be severely tried with the test of strong leaders. The fifth consideration is Rutherford's organization. The pastor had placed a board of directors and editorial committee in charge after his death. But Rutherford, through various legal maneuvers, seized control. The pastor's will was quickly laid aside. In a matter of a few months, Rutherford dismissed all that opposed him. The whole purpose and mission of the Watchtower was about to change. After seeing what happened, many left. The groups that formed almost immediately were first the PBI, the Layman's, and the Standfast Group. At the same time, others left and remained totally independent. The flurry of date setting also began almost immediately. Rutherford rushed the seventh volume to print in July 1917. It was claimed to be the posthumous work of Brother Russell, but it was actually a collection of writings from George Fisher and Clayton Woodworth. The seventh volume presents a number of dates, including 1918, 1920, 1921, and 1925. 1918 was at first thought to be the date when the church would go home. Then afterward, 1918 became the date the door would close. There was a lot of speculation. Now here's an example. Volume 7, page 258, quote, "The 3 days in which Pharaoh's host pursued the Israelites into the wilderness represents the 3 years from 1917 to 1920, at which time all of the Pharaoh's messengers will be swallowed up in the sea of anarchy. The wheels will come off their chariot organizations." Unfortunately, there were many more examples like this one. Types were used over and over again to attempt to prove false doctrine. While there were many new ideas, it is significant that the first major doctrine attacked was at the very heart of the presence. The 1925 date was based on a perversion of the prophetic jubilees. This distortion showed that the original multiple proofs of the jubilees were probably never understood. It removed one of them. Thus, it paved the way for other misunderstandings for years to come. With part of this major proof of the presence set aside, by 1933, Rutherford dropped the 1874 date, and he changed our Lord's return to 1914. Rutherford's 1920 publications, "Millions Now Living Will Never Die," laid even more emphasis on 1925. He not only claimed that the ancient worthies would be resurrected at that date, but he claimed that this meant that those that joined his organization would never die. In 1920, Rutherford also printed a new tabernacle, making many changes with the use of footnotes. Considering what follows it, the appendix begins with an astounding statement. Quote, "It will be noted that no basic teaching of this work is altered." Unquote. He then changed the court to be the state of the consecrated. An example is on page 19. The pastor's version reads, "Into this court only Levites, typical of justified believers, were allowed to come." Rutherford's version reads, "Into this court only priests, not Levites, typical of sacrificing believers, were allowed to come." Some that lived through these times described it as a slow drift from the truth. They described it like a frog in water who doesn't notice it's heating up. Hebrews 2:1. "Therefore, we ought to give more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip." Remaining in the organization for very long was bound to have its effects. Rutherford's doctrines on consecration in the court and his disregard for tentative justification has had its effects on the Bible student movement all the way to our day. We cannot help how many other doctrinal problems have come from Rutherford's organization. During the 1920s and 1930s, doctrines were changed in quick succession. Just a few are as follows. These, by no means, are all of them. By no means. In 1923, the sheep class in Matthew 25 were changed to a class living now. In 1927, the first resurrection of the sleeping saints was changed from 1878 to 1918. In 1932, Israel's place in the plan was replaced by Jehovah's Witnesses. By 1933, Christ's presence was changed from 1874 to beginning in 1914. In 1935, the Great Company was changed to an earthly class. That was a lot of change in just a little bit of time. Huge amount of change. It should be very sobering. Now we get to one of the most important issues of all. It strikes at the very heart of Christian liberty. It is the ecclesia arrangement. The ecclesia is a scriptural organization. What a wonderful arrangement. With each striving to vote not their will, but the Lord's, nothing better safeguards the truth. Rutherford began right away to chip away at the ecclesia arrangement. How much of a chip would be made all depended on an ecclesia and how much it would allow. From 1919 onward, Rutherford asked all congregations to register with the Watchtower as a service organization. A local service director was then appointed and members' names were centralized. The director started out as merely organizing things like field service in the congregation. But it expanded greatly after that. Thus, Rutherford's organization was running in parallel with the ecclesia arrangement. In 1928, he began an aggressive campaign to eliminate elected elders by congregational vote. According to a 1940 JW publication, by 1932, the system of elective elders was completely replaced. The August and September 1932 Watchtower aggressively printed articles claiming that the election of elders was not scriptural. Now, I've looked these up. This is definitely there. They have all of these online, by the way, now, those that have left that group. By 1933, Rutherford claimed that abolishing elective elders was the fulfillment of the 2300 days of Daniel, the cleansing of the sanctuary. Remember, it's when bad things do not seem so bad that we need to watch out. Again, it's when bad things do not seem so bad that it's time to wake up. A lot of bad things happened before 1933. Now for a personal eyewitness account. About 1932, during the culmination of the Watchtower efforts to centralize control under Rutherford, a known Watchtower agitator had been appointed by headquarters as a service director for the Chicago area. Many records show how this same person was used over and over again as a strong arm of Rutherford. On this occasion, he directed neighboring classes to attend to vote at a business meeting in the English class. Notice here, he brought in other classes to vote in the English class. It was one of the remaining classes in the area that was not yet under full control. During the meeting, some saw what was about to happen and courageously took action. Brother Irving Foss got the floor. He announced, "Next Sunday, we're going to study the volumes at 910 North LaSalle Street." Somebody shouted, "You can't do that." Brother Irving said, "I already have." And he walked out. His wife, Brother Wylam, Brother Reed, and the Hollisters and others followed. That week, many others who had previously left were called. This was the beginning of the current Chicago class. As we continue to consider the various Bible student histories today, it's important to mention that the intent is not to ridicule any group, and especially any person. Each of these examples should be sobering to us all, because none of us are immune to mistakes, and I think we all know that. Now, for our sixth item, the laymen's. On December 1918, P. Ellis Johnson began publishing the Layman's Home Missionary Movement. Was organized in 1920, and the Herald of the Epiphany was regularly issued thereafter. Right after the pastor's death, an ugly battle took place between Johnson and Rutherford. This battle and others remind us of the articles on anarchy in the church. Johnson claimed to be the Epiphany messenger. The Epiphany messenger. He used types extensively, and I mean extensively, and claimed to prove many bizarre things through the use of types. Do you notice a pattern here? The most important thing for today's discussion is that he taught that the door was closed in 1914. He did print the volumes, but without the 1916 forwards. They have them today, by the way, but after the internet. In the years after 1914, the forwards and reprint 5950 have been vital. That's vital in recognizing that we can still run for the high calling. Our seventh consideration is the Standfast Movement. On May 9th, 1918, the directors were arrested for sedition. This is a Watchtower Board of Directors. They were arrested for sedition. The seventh volume had many strong condemnations of both clergy and government. This book was a clear attempt to smite the Jordan. Based on a 1917 Espionage Act, on June 21st, Rutherford and the Board of Directors were sentenced to 20 years in prison. Brethren saw Rutherford then compromise in the attempt to get out of prison. He began to advocate war bonds. That was enough for some. The Standfast Bible Students Association was organized on December 1st, 1918, in Portland, Oregon. It published a bi-monthly issues of the Old Corn Gems thereafter. But soon, dissatisfaction with the Watchtower increased. Rutherford made more compromises. He made a deal to get out of prison. He agreed to cut out pages 247 to 253 in the seventh volume. And he told the brethren to do the same. That was enough for the government. That was not enough for the government, actually. He then agreed to entirely stop printing the seventh volume. As the brethren thought about this, they had more and more trouble with it. young Bible students were still in prison for conscientious objection, and now Rutherford was making deals to escape prison? Thousands left the society. Many joined the Stand Fast movement. These were standing fast for the seventh volume. Now, we often think of it as only a Northwest group, but that's not strictly true. The 1920 Corn Gems also listed conventions in places like Oklahoma, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. The movement had over 1,200 adherents in the U.S. and Canada. These strong characters were attempting to keep the truth, but they were humbled to make sure they would follow the Lord's will instead of their own. Unfortunately, these stood for the seventh volume and thus stood for the same false date setting as Rutherford's organization. This included the 1918 closing of the door, the 1920, 1921, and 1925 dates. They also took an extreme position in personal conduct and doctrine. This included judging those that differed as great company. Imagine. Our dear Brother Swanson wrote a short history of the Sandfast movement. He shared his own mistakes to help us. Now, page 6 of that history, quote, "One of the burning questions of those days was, what shall be our attitude toward the IBSA? These were those that stayed with Rutherford. We said, surely there should be no fellowship with any who had deliberately compromised the truth. Hence, some of the speakers taught that it was wrong to shake hands with the IBSA members, for handshaking was fellowshipping. A considerable number of us hastily accepted that teaching. Among them was the writer. He did not retain such an idea very long, however, but long enough to do a little harm. Actually, to do no little harm. One dear old sister, crippled and nearly blind, and a very dear friend of the writer, almost cry when I read this, had remained in the IBSA. He now deemed it his duty to actually disfellowship that old sister. But it was not long before he saw the error of such an attitude towards those who claim full consecration. Notice the issue was fellowship. Fellowship. Soon the Standfast movement itself split. Brethren left. As Brother Swanson said, we got a taste of our own medicine. Both groups then tried to believe that the other group was the great company. Now, our eighth consideration. The PBI. The Pastoral Bible Institute officially formed in November 1918 at a convention in Rhode Island. Now, I might mention that the PBI today is quite a different organization. It's not near what it was at that time. The PBI began to publish the Herald in December. It soon utilized an extensive pilgrim service for the serving the isolated brethren. The editors believed that the door was open. Fifth volume, page 296, suggests that Satan often attempts to divert the brethren from the truth by using extremes. For the Standfast movement, it was a conservative direction. For the PBI, it was the liberal extreme. The PBI began with a strong declaration on the presence and other major doctrines, but over time it lost its hold on these precious truths. In November and December 1921, a new chronology was published. Isn't that something? 1921. Zedekiah's overthrow was replaced, was placed in 588 BC. The Gentile times were revised to end in the autumn of 1933. These articles set aside the amazing fulfillments in 1914, along with the entire prophetic framework. It's still amazing. It's only 1921. Later books were distributed strongly proclaiming 1933. So this was not just a few passing articles. It was much more than that. By the mid-1930s, some of the New Covenant group had joined with the PBI and it had begun to greatly influence the group. Before long, the PBI was sending out speakers that did not believe in the presence and the sin offering. These were teaching the nominal church views of the New Covenant. Notice the problem here was not fellowship, but eldership. Eldership. Between 1939 and 1945, many class divisions took place due to these doctrinal deflections. In 1946, the booklet, When Pastor Russell Died, was written. It was a very good history of the Bible student movement. The present-day printing of this booklet has changed. We will read from the original. This booklet recounts much of what we've just covered. The new chronology, the loss of the presence, new covenant issue, etc. As he put it, they specialized in character development. And Brother Russell's ministry was more and more minimized. It recounts how the modernistic view of the unimportance of doctrine got its foothold. Not really realizing that this was a problem, throughout the country, classes disintegrated. Now let's read from the booklet. Quote, this specializing of the ministry, that is, the specializing in character development, did not hold the brethren together, nor did it provide them with the incentive to lay down their lives in the service of the truth. It was only part of the truth, and not the part of the truth either, which was the very life of the truth movement. Character development and devotionalism are fundamental in the Christian life. But these were not the truths which called the Lord's people out of Babylon. All the churches enjoy the blessings of formalistic devotionalism and assumed character development, but only those enlightened with present truth enjoy that understanding of the plan of God which sets them on fire with zeal to proclaim the glad tidings. Unquote. Finally, it was suggested that present truth is the glue that holds the brethren together. The glue. Isn't that what the scriptures say? Matthew 24:28. And wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered. We're not gathered for the sake of gathering. We're gathered to the carcass of present truth. Remember, let's remember, specialization can cause the loss of present truth. Our ninth item is the independence. By considering Bible student organizations, we only get a partial understanding of the Bible student history. Their brethren were scattered after the pastor's death. All the way through this period of time, there were brethren who tenaciously held on to the volumes. We would not have the truth today except for the Lord's precious overruling and these brethren. Many became freed up from organizations. They were often determined to remain independent. But when the volumes were printed again in the 1940s and 50s, it had the effect of gathering these brethren back together. In conclusion, can you see the fingerprints? 1914, the impact then. Before, all were energized. Afterward, the tests began. Were they consecrated to a date or to eternity? 2, truth just in time. The harvest message was supplied just in time. Truth was revealed gradually, but just in time. The forewords were written days before his death, just in time. 3, major prophetic framework. Did you see the difference between the clarifications before the pastor's death and the changes after? The timing of the major prophetic framework never changed. Why? Because the pastor could see the fingerprints of God, the incredible interlocking harmony and order. No man could have contrived it. 4, perilous times. Just before his death, the pastor wrote an article warning of ambitious leaders, again, just in time. Deuteronomy 13:3. That's Deuteronomy 13:3. Thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or the dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God doth prove you, to know whether ye love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. 5, Rutherford's organization. The test of strong leaders began. A flurry of dates were set 1918, 1920, 1921, 1925. The multiple proofs of the Jubilees and the major prophetic time framework were laid aside. Major doctrines changed rapidly, and the ecclesia arrangement was lost. John 8:31-32. If ye continue in my word, then ye shall might be my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Isn't it so true that the truth shall make you free? Free from the bondage of such errors and organizations. 6, the laymen's. Types were used extensively to teach new doctrines. They taught that the door was closed. Revelation 3:11, hold fast to that which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. 7, the standfast movement. Strong characters were attempting to stand for the truth, but were standing for error. Focused on speculation and types to the neglect of the 6 volumes and character development. Taught that it was wrong to fellowship and shake hands with some that differed. That's amazing. Judged other brethren into the great company. Matthew 7:2. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye mete out, it shall be measured to you again. It's very sobering. 7, the PBI. Specialized in character development. That's character development. Became more and more liberal, including publications setting aside the major prophetic framework. By the mid-1930s, speakers were sent out that did not believe in the presence, the sin offering, and other major doctrines. With the Standfast movement, the major issue was fellowship. With the PBI, it was eldership. Let's remember the test of specialization. Ephesians 6:13. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, the whole armor, that ye may be able to withstand in that evil day, and having done all, stand. Nine, the independents. These were independent of earthly organizations. They tenaciously held to the volumes. Have you seen the fingerprints of God? May the Lord overrule anything said amiss.